This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today, we start with a story from the October 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Sorcery by Frederick Pohl. The young talent booker behind the desk was slim, quick, heavily eyeshadowed, and Bocanegra decided quite ugly, and he hated her. He didn't much like her coffee either. Her office was tiny and bare. It didn't do justice to one of the richest television networks in the world, and besides, the woman was watching the wrong program. All of this displeased Marchese Bocanegra. Not that he cared that somebody on the NBC payroll was sneaking looks at an offering of CBS, but the program the confounded woman was watching was a pickup from the spaceship Algonquin on its way back from Mars with a bunch of those equally confounded Martians aboard. Nasty-looking things. People said they looked a little bit like seals, but seals, at least, didn't have spindly legs. No, they were hideous, although it wasn't their looks that made Bocanegra dislike them. The woman giggled. "They're cute," she said to Bocanegra, or to no one. Bocanegra sighed silently. He sat erect in his far from comfortable wooden chair, his hands folded reposefully on his lap, his expression unchanging and his eyes half closed. He could see her well enough. Her nose was hardly more than a pug, and her teeth, although white enough and bright enough, were unacceptably long. She was at least as unattractive as the Martians, not to mention that she wasn't treating him right. First, there had been 45 minutes in the waiting room outside, with all the jugglers and struggling comics and publicity agents for people who had just written a book. Then, when she did let him in, most of her attention was on the TV screen, when what she should properly have been doing was to decide exactly when, Bocanegra did not allow himself to say whether, he would appear again on the Today Show. Bocanegra didn't realize his half-closed eyes had closed all the way until he heard her say irritably, "What's the matter? Are you asleep?" He opened his eyes slowly and looked that had always gone so well on television. "I am not asleep," he said austerely. She was looking less attractive than ever because she was scowling at him, but at least she had turned off the television set. "I hope you wouldn't fall asleep on the air," she sniffed. "Sorry about that, but I had to watch. Anyway, how do you say your name?" "Marchese Bocanegra." "You can easily get screwed up trying to say those foreign names on the air," she said pensively. "What's that first part, a title or a name?" He allowed himself to twinkle. "It is the name my parents bestowed on me," he said, not truthfully. "It does, in fact, mean Marquis, but my family have not used a title for more than 100 years. That was not untruth, for technically they had not used one, or before that either, because grape growers hardly ever had one. "In any case," he went on smoothly, "I don't know if you have had an opportunity to study my sit rep. This latest contact..." "What in the world is a sit rep?" "The situation report, that is. It details my latest contact with the Great Galactics, which is actually far more excited than any I have experienced before. I was meditating before the fireplace in my summer home at Aspen, when suddenly the flames of the fire seemed to die away and a great golden presence emerged to..." "You told me," she said. "They talked to you. What I need to find out is what they said about the Martians." "Martians? My dear women, they aren't Martians. The Great Galactics come from so far beyond Mars that they are in another universe entirely, which we call the Theta Band of Consciousness." "Uh-uh, The people aren't interested in other universes right now, Mr. She glanced at her notes and pronounced it for a wonder, almost correctly, Mr. Bocanegra. I'm booking a particular show. I've got 1 3.5-minute spot open, and the show's about Mars. We've already got Sagan, Bradbury, and some woman from NASA. And we need somebody like you. I mean, now, you've had other experiences with flying saucers, right? He said patiently. Flying saucers is a newspaper term. I don't care for it. In my book, Ultimate Truth, The Amazing Riddle Behind the Saucer Flaps, I expose the falsity of the so-called flying saucer stories. On the theta level of reality, what we human beings perceive as saucers are really, no, but whatever they were, did any of them come from Mars? Of course not, then he added hastily. Naturally, on the other hand, most of the so-called Martian mysteries are explained in my book, as, for example, the huge stone sculpture of a human face that appears on Mars in no face. We've already got the guy who wrote the book doing that on the 818 spot on Tuesday. Anything else about Mars? She asked, glancing at her watch. No, said Bocanegra, coming to a decision. He had been in the business long enough to know when to cut his losses. She wasn't buying. He would not do the Today Show on the basis of this interview. All he could do was to try to keep the lines open for the future. As she was opening her mouth for the don't call us, we'll call you, he widened his eyes and said quickly, oh, just a moment. Do you mean next week? I am so terribly sorry. My staff must have got the dates wrong because next week I have to be at a conference in Washington. He gave the woman a meager, forbearing smile as he stood up and shrugged apologetically. As he picked up the gray suede gloves and gold-handled walking stick, the woman said, well, actually, no, I insist, Bocanegra cut in. It's entirely my fault. Good day. And he was gone, not even pausing to admire his reflection in the full-length mirror on the back of her door. It was just as it ought to be, anyway. Tall, spare figure in the severely cut black suit, the moon white stock gleaming at his throat, and the white carnation in his lapel, he was exactly as striking and vaguely sinister a spectacle as he set out to be. Color, the well-meaning had said to him. It's all color on the TV now. And it was. But for exactly that reason, Marchese Bocanegra had stood out in his stark black and white on the talk shows and panels. Had once, anyway. There weren't as many of them anymore. You could even go further. There practically were none at all. And the big reason for that was the Martians, how they had ruined it for everybody. Passing through the waiting room, Bocanegra gave the receptionist a quick four-fingered wave. It was the benediction and greeting of the great galactics, as he had demonstrated for more than 30 years in the field. But she didn't seem to recognize it. No matter, Bocanegra took the carnation from his buttonhole and led it caressingly before her. A receptionist who remembered you could make all the difference. Before pacing out to the hall, where he tapped the elevator button with the head of his cane. Only when the door had opened and he stepped inside did he say in surprise, Anthony, I didn't expect to see you here. The month was May and the day warm, but Anthony Makepeace Moore wore full regalia, fur-collared coat and black slouch hat. His expression was more startled than pleased. So was Bocanegra's own. But the two men greeted each other with the effusion of colleagues and competitors. Marchese, Moore cried, wringing his hand. It's been too long, hasn't it? I suppose you've been granting interviews, too? Bocanegra permitted himself a wry smile. I had intended to appear on the Today Show, he said. But the appearance they wanted me to make is, unfortunately, out of the question. And you?
Oh, nothing as glamorous as the Today Show, smiled Moore. I was just taping a few radio bits for the network news.
I'll be sure to listen, Bocanegra promised, the generosity of his tone almost completely concealing the envy. The network. It had been at least 2 years since any network news organization had cared to have Marchese Bocanegra say anything for their listeners. And now that they'd done more, it would certainly be a while before they wanted anyone else. There was a time, a pretty long ago time now, when the two of them had done publicity appearances together. But that was when the alien encounter business was booming. The fact was, now there just wasn't enough to share. So Bocanegra was surprised. Moore looked at his aviator glasses and his watch with the three dials and said diffidently, I suppose you're in a great hurry to get to your next engagement. As a matter of fact, Bocanegra began and then hesitated. He finished. As a matter of fact, I'm a bit hungry. I was thinking of a sandwich somewhere. Would you care to join me? Moore courteously bowed him out first as the elevator reached the ground floor.
I'd like that a lot, Marchese, he said warmly.
Any place in particular? Something ethnic, perhaps? You know how I like odd foods, and we don't get much of them in Oklahoma.
I know just the place, cried Bocanegra.
The very place was the Carnegie Delicatessen, half a dozen blocks from the RCA building, and both of them had known it well. As they walked up 7th Avenue, people glanced at them curiously. Where Bocanegra was tall, hawk-like, and aloof, Anthony Makepeace Moore was short and round. He wore bushy white sideburns on a head that had no other hair but bushy white eyebrows. He would have been plump even in a bathing suit, so one supposed. No one had ever seen him in one. But his standard costume, winter, spring, and fall, was a bulky coat trimmed with what might well pass for ermine. It made him appear even rounder. As much as anything, Moore resembled a fat leprechaun. What he wore in the summer was quite different, because in the summer he spent his time on the 500 acres of his Udarpan astral retreat just outside of Enid, Oklahoma. There he wore the robes of Udarpan masters. So did everyone else on the premises, though not all in the same color. Seekers, the paying guests, wore lavender. Adepts, the staff, wore gold. Moore himself, taking a cue from the Pope at Rome, never appeared in anything but spotless and freshly laundered white. At the delicatessen, Bocanegra stepped courteously aside to let Moore go first through the revolving door. It was mid-afternoon, but there was a short line waiting, and the two men exchanged amused glances. Fame, whispered Moore, and Bocanegra nodded. Your picture used to hang right there, next to the fan, he said. And yours, over by the door, Moore agreed. And now they don't even remember who we are. The cashier, overhearing, looked at them curiously, but no identification became before their table was ready. When Moore took off his coat, he revealed a red and white checked sports shirt underneath. No robes today? Bocanegra asked. The only answer he got was a frosty look. Then Moore began to pore over the menu, and his expression softened. That good old pastrami, he said sentimentally. Remember the tons of it at WOR, and Long John begging us to take some home because there'd be a new batch the next night? That's where we met, isn't it? Bocanegra laughed, knowing exactly that it was. The all-night Long John Nebel show had, in fact, given both of them their start in the alien contact industry. Remember the mystic barber with that tinfoil crown he always wore? And Barney and Betty Hill,
and the two men in black, and Will Ousler, and, oh, God, Marco, Moore said, rolling his eyes. We didn't know when we had it good, did we? We were so young. And no damned Martians to take people's minds off us, Bocanegra grumbled. Are you ready to order? They passed reminiscences back and forth while they were waiting for their food to arrive. Long John and his wonderful scams, the revolving Empire State Building, the bridge off the RCA Tower and all, and not only Long John, but every other broadcast medium. They all seemed willing to give airtime to talk about intelligences from other worlds, network TV and little local radio stations where you had to crouch between record turntables and hand a single microphone around the guests. We were so young, Moore said dreamily, pouring ketchup on his French fries. Remember Lonnie Zamora, Bocanegra asked, and the spaceport at Giant Rock, and the mutilated cows, and the car engines that got stopped, and, oh, God, the Bermuda Triangle. Good Lord, said Bocanegra earnestly. I can think of at least a dozen people that lived for years on just the Bermuda Triangle. You know what they were getting for a single lecture? Not counting the books and the workshops and... He trailed off. And everything, said Moore somberly. They ate in silence for a moment, thinking of the days when the world had been so eager to hear what they had to say. In those days, everyone wanted to give them a voice. Radio, television, press coverage. There was nothing anyone might say about flying saucers or men from another planet or mysterious revelations received in a trance or astral voyages to other worlds that did not get an audience, a paying audience. Both Moore and Bocanegra had their pick of college lecture dates and handsome honoraria, enough for Bocanegra to start the Press of Ultimate Truth, Inc., to print his books, enough for Moore to buy the tract of played-out Oklahoma grazing land that became the Udarpan Astral Retreat. Both had flourished wildly. There was no end to the customers for Bocanegra's books, more than 15 titles in all, or to the seekers who gladly paid a month's wages to spend a week in their lavender robes, eating lentils and raw onions out of EAR's wooden bowls and sneaking off to the truck stop just outside the retreat for hamburgers and sinful beer and listening worshipfully to Moore's revelations. When the last of the pastrami and fries were gone, Moore signaled for a coffee refill. He looked thoughtfully at Bocanegra and said, I've been looking forward to your new book. Is it out yet? It's been held up, Bocanegra explained. Actually, it was a year overdue, and the new book wasn't going to appear until the bills for the last one were paid, and that didn't seem likely in the near future. Of course, he added with as near a smile as he ever allowed himself in public, the timing might be better later on. It's all Martians now, isn't it? Moore was startled. Are you writing a book about the Martians? He demanded. Me? Of course not, Bocanegra said virtually. Oh, there are charlatans who'll be doing that, no doubt. I'll bet there are a dozen of the old guard trying to change their stories around to cash in on the Martians. Shocking, Moore agreed with a straight face. Anyway, I've about decided to take a sort of sabbatical. This fad will run its course. Perhaps in a few months it'll be the right time for my book, which tells how the great galactics have provided us with the genetic code that explains all of the mysteries of... Yeah, said Moore, staring into space. His expression did not suggest that he liked what he was seeing. Bocanegra studied his ancient adversary. It didn't look like a very good time to bring up the sudden inspiration that had come to him in the elevator. Moore sounded depressed. But there would never be a better time, so Bocanegra plunged in. I've been thinking, he said. Moore focused on him. Yes? Bocaneva waved a depreciating hand. I'll probably have some free time for a while, perhaps the whole summer. So I wonder, would you be interested in having me as a sort of guest lecturer at the retreat? Moore's eyes widened under the bushy eyebrows, but he didn't speak. Bocanegra went on ingratiatingly. Since I'm at liberty, I mean. Of course, we'd have to make some special arrangement. It wouldn't be appropriate for me to be there just as part of your staff. Some new position? Perhaps I could wear black robes. Naturally, the financial arrangements could be worked out. Professional courtesy and all that. He finished with a twinkle. The twinkle dried up. Moore's expression was stony. No chance, he said. Bocanegra felt the muscles in his throat begin to tighten. No chance, he repeated, trying to keep the sudden anger out of his voice. Well, if it's the robes, it isn't the robes, said Anthony Makepeace Moore. No, it wouldn't be that, since I suppose you and I have been pretty much opponents for so long. Marco, said Moore sadly, I don't give a shit about that. I can't take you on at the retreat because there isn't going to be any retreat this year. I haven't got the customers. This time I should have 40 or 50 people registered. Some years I've had 100. You know how many I've got now? 2. And one of those is only a maybe. He shook his head. The whole thing's down the tube if something good doesn't happen. The bank's been on my back about the mortgage, and they put in that damn interstate, and even the truck stops losing money every week. Bocanegra was startled. I didn't know you owned the truck stop. Well, this time next month I probably won't. They even took out the Coke machine. Bocanegra sat in thoughtful silence for a moment. Then he laughed out loud and waved to the grouchy waitress for more coffee. You too, he said. Well, let's put our heads together and see if we can figure something out. By the time of the fourth refill, the waitress was muttering audibly to herself. The problem wasn't just the flicker tastes of the public. It was the Martians. There simply was no room for imaginary wonders in the public attention when the real thing was getting a few hundred miles closer to Earth every day. And the unfair part of it was that the Martians were so damned dull. They didn't have spiritual counseling for the troubled billions of Earth. They didn't warn of impending disasters or offer hope of salvation. They just stood there in their stalls on the spaceship Algonquin, swilling their scummy soup. I guess you've gone over it all in back to see if there's about Martians in any of them? Moore said hopefully. Bocanegra shook his head. I mean, yes, I looked. Nothing. Me too, Moore sighed. I'll tell you the truth, Marco. I never for one minute considered the possibility that when we were visited by creatures from outer space, they would be stupid. Say, he cried, sitting up. What if we say they aren't real? I mean, they're like the household pets of the real Eudarpans. The great galactics, Bocanegra corrected eagerly. Or maybe not pets, but, you know, like false clues the superior beings put there to throw us off the trail. And we can say we've had revelations about it and, well, hell, Marco, said Moore, suddenly facing reality. Would anyone believe us? Has that ever made any difference? No, but really, it'd be good if we had some kind of, you know, evidence. Evidence, Bocanegra said thoughtfully. See, these Martians will actually be here in a few months, right? Next thing you know, they'll be landing and they'll be in a zoo or something, and people can see them for themselves. They kind of talk a little bit, you know. Maybe they'd say something that could blow us right out of the water. They really are stupid, Tony. Yes, but Marco, if they've got some kind of writings that we don't know about, because all we've ever seen is what they sent on the TV from the spaceship, but Maybe they're degenerate, Bocanegra cried, so they don't know what that stuff really means. Well, Moore said doggedly, there might be a real problem there all the same. If we wait until they land, then he shook his head. Scratch that. We can't wait that long, at least I can't. I could stall the creditors for maybe a month or two, but the spaceship isn't going to land till nearly Christmas. And this is only June, Bocanegra puzzled for a moment. There had been, he was almost sure, something good they had come quite close to. But what was it? How about, said Moore, if we found some other Martians? Bocanegra frowned. Besides the ones they found, you mean? Somewhere else on Mars? Not necessarily on Mars, but the same sort of creatures. Maybe on Venus, maybe on the moon. We say they live in caves, say, so nobody's seen them. That's what they do on Mars, right? They could even have been some long ago on, what's it named? That moon of Jupiter that's always having volcanic eruptions? Only the volcanoes killed them off? Said Bocanegra, yeah, maybe. He was scowling in concentration because that faint ringing of cash registers was still in his ears, only he couldn't quite tell where it came from. I don't see where we can get any kind of evidence that way, he pointed out. I'd like it if we had something right here on Earth about that. Okay, Antarctica? There's a colony of them on Antarctica, or at least there used to be, but they died of cold after the continents migrated. There are people all over Antarctica, Tony, Russians and Americans and everybody. Well, at the bottom of the sea, they've got those robot submarines going down there all the time. Sure, Moore said, improvising, but those are all U.S. Navy or something, aren't they? The subs have been all the proof in the world, but the government's covering up. That's good, Bocanegra said thoughtfully. Let's see if I've got the picture. There were beings like these Martians all over the solar system once. Of course, they're not really Martians. It's just that the first live specimens that turned up were on Mars, all right? They've been on Earth, too, ever since the time the Great Galactics came. The people from planet Theta, too, he added quickly. And all these years they've been hiding down there, exerting an influence on what has happened to the human race. It hasn't all been good. Wars, depressions, crazy fads, Moore put in. Right, and all the things that have gone wrong. It's because these Martians have been willing it. They're degenerated and become evil. We don't call them Martians, of course. We call them something like emissaries or guardians, or what's a bad kind of guardian? Dead souls, said Moore triumphantly. Oh, sure, they're dead souls. Sounds kind of Russian, but that's not bad either, and they've been in Antarctica under the ice. Oh, no, he said disappointed. It won't work. We can't get to Antarctica. So how do we get evidence that there really are dead souls there? I don't really see why you keep harping on evidence, Moore said irritably. I don't mean evidence like finding a real, live, dead soul kind of Martian, Bocanegra explained. You know, we need some sort of message, mystic drawings, carvings, something like the Cuzco lines or the rune stone. Of course, he explained, they wouldn't be in any earthly language. We work our translations, partial translations, because we don't give the whole thing at once. We keep translating new sections as we go along. We get the key from planet Theta in a trance, Moore said helpfully. Or astral projection, Bocanegra nodded, from the Great Galactics. He thought for a moment and then said wistfully, but it would be better if we had something to take photographs of. I always put photographs in my book. They really make a difference, Tony. Maybe we could crack open some rocks, like Richard Shaver, and find mystic drawings in the markings. I don't like to repeat what anybody else has done, Bocanegra said virtuously, and I don't know where Shaver got the rocks either. Maybe in a cave, or... He stopped in mid-sentence, the ringing of the cash bells now loud and clear. They stared at each other. A cave, Moore whispered. Not under the ocean, under the ground, Tony. Are there any caves under the retreat? Not a one, Moore said regretfully. I didn't think of that when I bought the tract. But listen, there are millions of caves all over. All we have to do is find one big one with a lot of passages no one ever goes into. There are lots right along the Mississippi River, Bocanegra chimed in. There's even the Mammoth Cave or Carlsbad. Why, there are some in Pennsylvania that haven't even been explored much. And then maybe I can say I've seen the carvings while I was in astral projection. And then I can actually go there and discover them and take pictures, Bocanegra finished triumphantly. I wouldn't say where they came from at first, until we got a chance to put the drawings there. And nobody would argue, because everybody knows you and I have never worked together. And they'd be kind of like Shaver's Deros, only not deranged robots. They'll look like the Martians because they're the same dead souls, and they mess everything up for humanity because they're evil. And we'll split the money, Moore cried. You do your books, I'll do the retreats. Maybe along about Labor Day, you and I can have a public reconciliation, submerging our old differences, because now we've discovered this ultimate reality not even we suspected before. And I can come to the retreats. And sure, you can have black robes, Moore said generously. Marco, it's doable. The good old days are coming back for sure. The two men smiled at each other, their minds racing. Then Moore said, what about the Today Show? That'd be a great place to start if you can get in. Bocanegra pursed his lips. Thank heaven he'd sweetened the receptionist. She'd let him in, probably, and then he could just walk in on the booking woman. Then it would just be a matter of how fast he could talk. At least 50-50, he estimated, if I can get back to NBC before the offices close. And I'll go right down to the library and start looking up caves, Moore said. And we don't want to be seen too much together. So what do you say I just get together for a minute later on tonight with you, say about 7? Lobby of the Grand Hyatt, Bocanegra agreed. He clapped his hands imperiously at the waitress, sulking by the kitchen door. She came over and dropped the check in front of him. I'll get the tip, Moore offered, pulling out a handful of silver. Bocanegra, back in character, merely inclined his head in silent agreement, although inside he was marking up the mental ledger. 9.50 for the pastrami sandwiches, and only 5 quarters for the tip. Next time they would eat in a better place, and he would take care of the tip. As he waited for the cashier to fill out the slip on the one remaining valid credit card, Bocanegra said suddenly, "My cane!" He hurried back to the table before the waitress got there and picked up 2 of the quarters. Then he rejoined Anthony Makepeace Moore at the door, and the two prophets went out into the world they were about to conquer. We continue with a story from the June 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Turning Off by Larry Tritton. Because he was unable to resist an authentic bargain, Mandel was quick to notice the handsome FM-AM radio with a $5 price tag appended the day it appeared in the window of the pawn shop he passed each morning on his way to work. Since he had recently swept his own radio off an end table and smashed it beyond repair while practicing solitary entrechats in his tiny, cramped studio apartment, he went into the pawn shop to have a look at the machine. The man behind the counter was small and hairless, with the exception of great ursine eyebrows lurking above a carefully premeditated blank stare. Driving a fistful of knuckles into a massaging palm, he squandered a lavish smile and said, "May I help you?" Fearing that he was about to be assaulted with a salvo of professional high-pressure sales talk, Mandel muttered, "Just looking," darted a furtive glance around the glittering confines of the shop, and took up an oblique position at the far end of the counter, where he pretended to study with mild interest a display of old-fashioned jeweled stick pins. But shortly, he braced himself for encounter, sidled up towards the clerk, and asked candidly, "What's wrong with the $5 radio?" Eyebrows quailing, the man snapped, "Something would be wrong with a good guy?" "It must be a $70 piece," Mandel pointed out suspiciously. "75, and you can check. Also, there's nothing wrong, too. A buy is a buy, isn't it?" "I don't know," Mandel hedged. The man fetched the radio from the window and set it on the counter, caressing the top with a gentle touch. Mandel noticed that the radio sported a brand name with which he was unfamiliar, Providence. "A buy is a buy," the clerk repeated. He turned on the radio, and a young woman's voice, clear and resonant, issued from the speaker. "Once I would like to have someone love me for myself and not because I'm easy." "You want to stand here and test this?" the man said to Mandel. "Just go ahead. I'm not pushy. I'll be down there at the end of the counter polishing old pennies." "Never mind. I'll take it," said Mandel, reaching for his wallet. It was his style to act by impulse when the mood was upon him. That night, after supper, Mandel removed the radio from the Woolworth shopping bag in which it had been wrapped, set it on his kitchen table, and turned it on. He was in the mood for Beethoven symphonies, but would settle for Bach. The radio hummed warmly, lights vaguely perceived through chinks in its frame glowed dimly, but it remained silent. Mandel kept turning the tuning dial in brisk arcs without luck and was almost ready to give up when a frail, elderly voice murmured through the speaker, "I shouldn't go up in these things. My heart isn't top-notch anymore, and I never did care for heights anyway." A teenage girl's excited voice abruptly replied, "Oh, come on, Grandpa, you'll love it. Wait till you get a look at things from up there." The old man responded with a chuckle and said, though a little hesitantly, "Well, I'll try anything once, honey. Didn't I take two bad ones in the head at Chateau Thierry? Okay, let's go. Here, you get the tick." Angrily, Mandel twisted the dial in search of another station. "Where's Beethoven?" he asked the tabletop, but there were no other stations. In exasperation, he switched back to AM, but found nothing there. Then he returned to the single station once more. I don't feel well," the old man was saying. His voice was crackly, reedy, ominous. "We're up so high." Mandel snapped the radio off with an irritable gesture. "What kind of number is this?" he muttered indignantly to the floor. He went to the newspaper and found that no dramatic programs were scheduled that evening. Then, scowling, turned on the radio again. A dense, beefy voice was saying, "Hey, May, hand me out a couple of them rags and I'll get the outside of this window." There was a sound of someone crossing a room, deliberate feminine clicking of heels, then a woman's alarmed cry. For God's sake, Harry, get off of that ledge. You'll break your neck." A loud eruption of dismissive male laughter. "I'm okay. Now just hand me." With a sigh, Mandel switched off the radio and stood staring at it with baleful intent. "I give up on you," he told the unpredictable machine. "If you don't shape up tomorrow, back you go." An ultimatum. At work the following day, Mandel found it difficult to concentrate effectively on his job, that of a writer of story continuity for a comic book magazine called Psychotic Tales.
halfway through a tale about a timorous accountant who decorates his apartment with viscera gleaned from various individuals who at one time or another had slighted him, his mind balked, and all he could think about was his new radio. He considered leaving his cubicle and straying next door to the art department with his odd story, but finally decided he would only garner perplexed gazes. Returning to his work, he managed to muster enough imagination to bring the accountant to justice in a fashion both grisly and poetic. At 5 o'clock, as usual, he took the bus home. Someone had discarded a newspaper in the seat. Mandel chose to sit in, and to kill time, he picked it up and glanced absently through its pages. Two stories, relegated to the obscurity of the back page of the classified ad section, caught his attention. World War I hero dies. Irving J. Dander, 83, of 3583 Coy Drive, Sherman Oaks, suffered a fatal heart attack yesterday while riding the Ferris wheel at Disneyland with his 12-year-old granddaughter, Melinda, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. George Dander of Pasadena. Police officer Gordon Morris, who was on the scene, said that Dander was already dead when he was taken from the Ferris wheel. Dander, a corporal with the AEF during World War I, distinguished himself during the Battle of Chateau Thierry by leading an attack against the enemy in spite of two severe head wounds. He was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross and the French Croix de Guerre for the action. And fatal plunge from window. A 49-year-old North Hollywood truck driver fell to his death from the third-story ledge of his apartment late yesterday while attempting to clean a window. Police said that several persons witnessed the accident that took the life of Walford Dow of 6911 Fulton Avenue. Dow was killed instantly by the fall. His wife said that he had just returned from work and had suddenly decided to clean a dirty window that had been annoying him for several days. Mandel folded the newspaper and tucked it under his seat. During the remainder of the bus ride, he sat staring out the window, lips pinched into a motionless pout. By the time he got off the bus, he was humming Tea for Two under his breath to keep his mind from staggering to extravagant and dispiriting conclusions. He ate a glum TV dinner in his apartment, and when he had finished, tried to focus his attention on a book about improvisational religion by a Georgetown University theologian. But before half an hour had passed, he was at the radio, tuning in on a conversation between a man named Elmore and a woman named Tonya. "Look, Tonya, you want a mark on the face? I'll provide it," Elmore bellowed, in a tone edged with indignation. The woman made a crazed snorting sound. "You slap me, Elmore? I'll slap you right back, so help me God. Baby, I'll tell you, I'll break your lips if you don't shut the hell up." "I'm not afraid of you, lover boy." Mandel twisted his features into an expression of ornate bafflement, sat upright rigidly, and quickly snapped off the radio, hearing, in the same moment, a strident pealing of braked tires like a frenzied scream in the background, just before the voices were cut short. He gazed at the radio for a moment, then turned it back on and tried to tune in other stations. There were none. After pacing aimlessly around the apartment for a while, he sat down and called one of the popular local radio stations. "Something weird is going on here," he told the man. "I just get voices on my radio. No music." "There's music," the man assured him. "Try harder." The next night, on his way home from work, he bought a newspaper. Taking a seat in the back of the bus, he opened the paper reluctantly. On page 28, beside an ad for imported margarine, he read, "Man and wife killed
in hit-and-run accident. A married couple from Council Bluffs, Iowa, Elmore A. Baum, 51, and his wife Tonya, 46, were both killed instantly yesterday night when struck by a hit-and-run motorist at the intersection of Hollywood and Vine Street. A confectionery design specialist, Raymond Noldy, 35, of Long Beach, witnessed the accident. He told police that he had just left a bar when he saw a car plunge through a red light and strike the Baums as they were crossing the street. Noldy said it was too sudden for him to make out the model of the car or the number of its license plate. "Coincidence," whispered Mandel to himself, closing the newspaper, but his cheeks paled considerably and he slumped down in his seat, turning to fix his blitzed vision on anything other than the newspaper wilting in his hand. When he got home, he put the radio on a shelf in the back of a closet and forced all thoughts of it out of his mind. He spent the evening reading about an Aboriginal tribe in the hinterlands of Ecuador who worshipped the multiplication table, and watching a television talk show host conduct a seminar on the international deaf-mute hand signal alphabet with three gesticulative guests. When the talk show was over, he took a sleeping pill and went to bed. The pill, however, failed to work, and after two interminable sleepless hours, Mandel was up and on his way to the closet. Hesitating only momentarily, he turned on the radio. "One cop says one more word, I'm gonna carve him," concluded a youthful male voice, bitter with anger. "Easy, Romero, boy, easy," cautioned a tranquil older voice. "Don't tell me easy, Benny, goddammit. You want to taste steel yourself?" "Crazy, crazy," muttered Mandel, blotting sweat from his forehead with the back of a hand. He reached to turn off the radio, but a sense of vertigo swept towards him, and his hand faltered. He eased down the volume dial so that the radio was silent, though still on, then rushed into the bedroom, dressed, and fled from the apartment. It was a windy and starless night, and Mandel walked several blocks aimlessly before finally heading up beneath the blinking neocandescent neon sign of a neighborhood bar called the D. Boone Killed a Bar. Inside, the decor was frontier style, and he took a seat in a corner booth under the sheltered figure of a dusty stuffed raccoon and ordered gin and tonic from a girl wearing an abbreviated gingham dress with deep décolletage and a black silk sunbonnet tilted atop her new wave coiffure at a rakish angle. After three lingering drinks, he got up and left, just as a group of feathered and buckskin-clad Indians came milling into the place and returned to his apartment. Mandel tickled the radio's volume dial uncertainly with a forefinger. "Cop can lay that squip on me," Romero's voice shrilled out of control. "No, no, no, not for real," Mandel chanted. He felt an apoplectic surge in his chest. With icy deliberation, he switched off the radio. The next morning, like stalked prey, he slinked into his cubicle and dropped into the chair behind his desk. His hands were unsteady, his stomach amok. Before he could get to work, he was interrupted by a fragile, bird-like character in a dark suit who rushed headlong into the cubicle and dipped his head in brief greeting, blurting, "Here I am," sort of like the voice of your conscience. "But don't worry, you're off the hook. We'll overlook the old guy, the window washer, and the couple from Council Bluffs, although you should have known better after those first two, and did deep down inside. None of them were really due yet, you know. Well, anyway, all I want is the radio, and here's the five spot it set you back." The man made a quick ruffling gesture and fluttered a $5 bill out of his pocket. "What I really want is an explanation," Mandel said, his heart suddenly burgeoning against his chest. "Don't be cute," the man said. "Try and see my side. We can't have those things out among the public. Control would bitch. Oh, I'm not saying they haven't gone out before. It gets awfully dull out there with nothing to do but turn dials. And Control's not humorless. Sometimes he gives us a day or two in some place like Hungary or the Bermuda Triangle with carte blanche. But anything we bring with us, we take back. That's standard pro. Now, I don't know how that radio got..." "I don't like this," Mandel cut in. "Can't you clarify it? How do I know who you are?" The man frowned. "That's gratitude. You ease someone off the hook, and right away they want a crash course in metaphysics. I just want to know more." "Are you coming across, Mandel?" the man said, waving the bill. "I just want to know more," Mandel persisted. He was beginning to sweat, but had struck a stubborn stance. "I'm not going to coerce you," said the man, turning and hurried out of the cubicle. At 5 that afternoon, Mandel bought a paper and stood on a street corner, glancing shakily through the pages. He found the headline on the second page: "Police Officer Murdered." He didn't bother to read the story. With a gelatinous stride, he made his way to the bus and rode home in silence. That night, at 7, the doorbell chimed. When he opened the door, the bird-like man flew quickly into the apartment. "I'm crazy, but I'll give you $10, he said. "Come on now, fork it over. You're getting scared and don't want to get involved, and you're screwing up organization badly. Take this." He thrust the 10 into Mandel's hand. Mandel stared inattentively at the money. "I want to, but I can't," he told the man. "Look, I've been doing some thinking. I think I'm going to bring the police in on this. I don't know yet, but why should I listen to you? How do I know who you are? Show me your credentials." The other began to hum. "How are you going to keep him down on the farm?" while studying Mandel closely and shaking his head. "Christ, Mandel," he said, "you're being downright silly, and deep down inside, you know it. I told you, we're full of tricks, but if that's the way you want it..." Mandel had an impulse to whirl about, seize the radio, and shove it into his visitor's arms, saying, "Here, take it, I'm sorry." But instead, he stood mutely, shoulders back. "That's it," said the man. Turning, he whisked abruptly out of the apartment, humming, "Thanks for the memories." The next morning, before going to work, Mandel confronted his image in the mirror and said, "It doesn't matter that I may have a $1 million gadget. When I get home tonight, I'm taking the damn thing straight to the police." His reflection regarded him skeptically. "Well," he retorted, "I am." Arriving at his office, Mandel assaulted his work with rigidly programmed detachment. He worked straight through his lunch hour, even disdaining coffee breaks. The day passed so quickly that when he rose from his desk, having produced 2 complete stories, he saw that he had worked nearly an hour overtime. It was almost 6. Slipping on his coat, he said absently, "Now, for that other deal." In the elevator, he greeted Hanks, one of the artists, a lean, splay-featured man who drew a regular feature called Grave Rat. "Work late?" Mandel asked. Hanks nodded, then broke into a smile. "Hey, man, what's with this actor bit? You breaking into showbiz, Mandel?" "Huh?" Mandel said, noticing for the first time that Hanks held a small, compact FM radio in one hand. "Very thoughtful of you," Hanks said, indicating the radio with a nod. "Just before most of us left the office, your guy came in and distributed the radios and told us about the program. Nobody even knew." As the elevator doors sighed open and both men stepped into the lobby, Mandel suddenly did a flawless and grandiose pirouette, whirling in mid-glide to grasp Hank's arms and gasp, "What? What? No, no!" Hanks recoiled, and Mandel spun around in a tight circle in the lobby, twisting his body in a series of panicky shuffling leaps and bawling as realization enveloped him. No, no, no! And then someone, somewhere, decided that he was not nearly as interesting as the late afternoon reruns of Bonanza and shut him off. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.